Everybody knows that there are so many commentaries on the Haggadah. I myself have more than 50 last time I counted. And what we're going to do is the greatest hits. There are certain things that I like to mention on a regular basis. And I hope that they can add to each of yours Darim as well. We'll do them according to the Haggadah. So if you want to take notes, they'll be in an orderly fashion. Let's start with Halachma Anya. By the way, did you people get the sheet that I asked Rav Eitan to publicize? I guess not. Okay, but you all know the Haggadah anyway, so it shouldn't be a problem. Okay, we will start out with Halachma Anya. Shalom. Who just joined us? Was that Miri?
Hi,
Mary.
Good,
good. Baruch Hashem. Okay, the Halach Ma'anya, we start out by saying this is the poor bread that our forefathers ate in Eretz Mitzrayim. Kol dichvin yeti v'yechol, whoever is hungry is invited to come. Kol ditzrich yeti v'yivsach, whoever is needy can come and do the Pesach with us. Hashata hacha, this year we are here. Lishana haba'a ba'aradi Yisrael. Next year, we hope to be in Israel. Hashata avdi, this year we are slaves. Lishana haba'a b'nei chorin. Next year, we will hopefully be free people. And I want to offer two explanations. Number one, I saw a very, very interesting story by there's a famous Italian Jew named Primo Levi. He is a famous writer, and he was an inmate in one of the death camps. And he tells the story of how, on the day of liberation, when the Allied forces came in and the Germans ran away, the first reaction of everybody was to go and to loot. Everybody ran into the kitchen and ran to the Germans' homes, and they took all the food and all the warm clothing and anything they could. And Primo Levi found a tanur chimum, a heater, which wasn't working. It was a gas heater, and he knew how to work with his hands. And he decided, instead of going to loot the food with all the other Jews and inmates, he decided that if he can get the heater to work, that's not only good for him, but it will help everybody in the bunk. Food is just good for me. Heating is for everybody in the bunk. Anyway, as he was working, he realized that he was losing out on the food. But he figured, oh, Baruch Hashem, we now have freedom. Hopefully we'll have food on a regular basis. And after working on the heater for about a half hour, a friend of his came and brought him some food that he had looted. And both of them were overcome with happiness, because one of the aspects of being a free person is that you can help other people. And when a person is an inmate in a death camp, and every single piece of bread and every calorie is so important, and even for Pikuach Nefesh, for 5-6 years, he and all the inmates basically were thinking just about themselves and didn't have the opportunity to do chesed. And here it was, on the day of the liberation, the two of them, for the first time in 5-6 years, did chesed. He gave up on his food that he could have gotten by looting to work on the heater for everybody. His friend gave part of his portion to Primo, and they both broke out in laughter and joy. And that's what we say in Halach Ma'anya. At the very beginning of the Pesach Seder, we invite all the poor people to come and join us. Why? Because that's the greatest example of freedom. Again, poor people, people who are starving, have difficulty doing chesed. But part of the signs that bring a free person is that you can overcome your selfishness and start doing chesed. And that's one explanation why we start out the Seder with Halach Ma'anya, inviting the poor people. A second explanation goes in a totally, totally different direction, and that is the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer starts by asking seven questions. Write down the questions, because the beauty is when you see that one answer answers all of the questions, it really is very convincing. Question number one. The Halach Ma'anya that we just read, where we invite all the poor people to come and join us for our Seder, this is the bread of poverty. Why do we say that in Aramaic? If the idea is so that everybody should understand, we should say it in a language that everybody understands. Today in Israel, we should say it in Hebrew, or you should say it in English. Question number one, why is it in Aramaic? And if it's so important to understand, so we should say, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, the three most important parts of the Seder, we should also be saying that in Aramaic. So that's a question. Why Davka this we say in Aramaic? Question number two. If in fact Halach Ma'anya is to invite the poor people to our Seder, why don't we open the door and yell out to the poor people in the streets, Halach Ma'anya, Kol Dichvin, anybody who's hungry is invited in. Right? If we take the trouble to stand up and open the door for Eliyahu Anavi, and we're not even sure if he's there, why, if we really want to invite the poor people, we should open the door and invite them. Question number two. Question number three is, if really Halach Ma'anya is an invitation to the poor people, we should invite them before Kiddush, not after Kiddush. Our poor people are obligated to have the four cups, just like everybody. So if the idea is to help the poor people, we should invite them mamash at the beginning of the Seder before Kiddush. Why are we saying it after Kiddush? Question number five is, the Gemara Masech Pesachim gives a klal. Ein lecha ani b'Yisrael, there is no person in Israel who is so poor that he doesn't have money to buy four cups of wine, matzah, everything that he needs. Because Am Yisrael gives money beforehand. Some places it's called Ma'ot Chitim, Ma'os Chitim. Other places it's called Kimcha de Pischa. But I'm sure in all of your communities, even if you don't know, your parents give money to the poor people in the community before Pesach. And that is an ancient custom. And Chazal tell us that by Leil HaSeder, all the poor people are taken care of. And if so, why in the world are we inviting the poor people to our Seder if they're already taken care of? Question number five. Why Davka in Pesach do we invite the poor people? It's a really nice idea, beautiful idea. So on Sukkot, we should also start the Sukkah meal with an invitation of who's ever hungry, let them join us. Question number six. What is the connection between the invitation that we're inviting the poor people and the end of the paragraph, which says that this year we are slaves, this year we are in Galut, next year hopefully we will be free people in Eretz Yisrael? What's the connection? And the seventh and final question is, to this day, in Eretz Yisrael, we still say the Halach Ma'anya, where the last line is, we hope next year to be in Eretz Yisrael. But we are in Eretz Yisrael, so why do we still say it? Just because of the end that we hope next year to be Bnei Chorin? Here also, you could say in the land of Israel, we are independent. We have an independent state. Bekitzur, seven questions, and the Chatam Sofer answers all of them with a very beautiful and convincing answer.
Just one answer?
One answer answers all the questions. By the way, anybody who's familiar with Gemara knows that those are by far the most convincing answers. Because if you have seven questions and seven answers, simply the amount of questions bothers us. Why are there so many questions, even if I have answers? But if I have seven questions and I have one answer to answer all of the questions, that's a sign that there's something very basic that I was missing And now that I understand, everything makes sense. Okay? The Chatam Sofer explains that Halach Ma'anya was a kina. A kina, like we say, kinot on Tisha B'Av, where the Jews, when they were sent to exile to Babylon, to Bavel, they were crying on Pesach at the beginning of the Seder because they're missing the real Pesach. Most of you probably know that the word Pesach really refers to the Korban Pesach. The main part of the Leil HaSeder is missing. Magid is very nice, matzah, maror, everything that we do at Leil HaSeder is very nice. But the main part of the Seder, we're missing out. And that is Halach Ma'anya Diachala Vatana Ba'ara de Mitzrayim. Why do we say it in Aramaic? Because Aramaic was the language of the Jews in Bavel. They were the ones who invented the Halach Ma'anya paragraph. Kol dichfin yaiti v'yechol, according to the Chatam Sofer, is not an invitation to the poor people. And that answers most of the questions. What does it literally mean? Anybody who's hungry can just come and eat with us? With a question mark? Kol ditzrich yaiti v'yivsach, anybody who wants to can just hop over and do Pesach with us? That's not Pesach, because the most basic law of the Korban Pesach, of the Paschal Lamb, was that as the lamb was slaughtered, you had to know all of the people that you're slaughtering it for. All of the people, you could be slaughtering it and give one kezayit to 200 people. But you have to have the name list at the time of the Shechita. Actually, just today, I don't know if anybody ever visited my website in Yeshivat Beit El. Just Google Yeshiva Ari Shvat. Somebody asked me a very interesting question. He said, how are we going to give a Korban Pesach? You have to prepare it beforehand, and you have to check it to make sure that there's no mumim, no blemishes. And for sure, from Yud, Nisan, you have to keep it for 4 days. And if the Mashiach comes, or if the Beit HaMikdash, you don't need Mashiach for Beit HaMikdash. Say we build the Beit HaMikdash on Erev Pesach. How are we going to give Korban Pesach? So I answered him that I personally know several people who designate a sheep for Korban Pesach. And whoever signs up, they have in mind. Now, that solves the problem of anybody who signs up. But somebody who doesn't sign up, really, even if the Beit HaMikdash is built, you can't give Korban Pesach if you're not on the list. In other words, in the real Pesach, you can't just pop in on somebody on Leil HaSeder and say, I'm here, thanks for inviting me. The Chatam Sofer is saying it's not an invitation. It is a kina that we're mourning with a question mark, as if saying, this is Pesach? In Bavel, the Jews were mourning, this isn't Pesach, that anybody who's hungry can come in and be with us. Anybody who wants to pop over at the last minute can do with us Pesach. That doesn't work with the real Pesach. And that explains why we also say at the end, this year, we are here, but next year, we hope to be in Eretz Yisrael. And even if you're in Eretz Yisrael, we still say, next year, we hope to give the Korban Pesach in a way that we can't have people popping in. Just to answer all the questions, the Chatam Sofer is saying, A, why is it in Aramaic? Because this is what the Jews spoke when they cried in Bavel that they no longer have a Korban Pesach. What about all the questions about inviting people? If we really wanted to invite them, we should open the door. And if we really wanted to invite them, we should say Halach Ma'anya before Kiddush. And if we really wanted to invite them, we should invite them on other holidays as well. And not only that, we said before, the Gemara says there are no poor people already by Pesach time. The answer is, says the Chatam Sofer, this is not an invitation to invite poor people. It is a kina, crying that what we're about to do, even though I love the Seder Pesach, it's not the real Seder Pesach. That kol dichvin yeti v'yechol, anybody who wants to come can just drop in and do the Pesach. Aiden, what do you want to say?
What's a kina?
Kina. On Tisha B'Av, we say kinot, right? Kinos in Ashkenazic. So a kina is a prayer of mourning.
Oh, so like we're like upset, so like that's why like we're telling people to come?
That's why we're saying we can't invite people to come. Because in the real Korban Pesach, you're not allowed to invite somebody at the last minute. He has to be on your list already the day before when you're shechting the Korban Pesach. In other words, it has nothing to do with an invitation. The idea is that we're mourning that we don't have the Korban Pesach, which is the main part of the Seder. Should be the main part of the Seder. Got it?
Okay, yeah, sure.
Okay. Let's go on. In the Manishtana, one of the questions that my grandson will ask me on Leila Seder is the first question. Shebechol ha'leilot anu ochlim chametz u'matzah, ha'layla hazeh kulo matzah. And the question is, what does chametz literally mean? Anybody who knows Hebrew well knows that the word lahachmitz is not just to turn into leaven, to raise the bread from the dough, but also in daily speech, when a person misses out on something, you miss out on an opportunity, you say, Hichmatzti, I lost out on the opportunity. Now, this is a very important aspect of chametz, because I have to admit, I remember in my shul in Chutz La'aretz, where I was growing up in Riverdale, the shamis had a minhag that the janitor, the non-Jew of the shul, he would bring him beer, and he would make havdalah on beer. And it always bothered me, what, you can't wait 10 minutes, a half hour, you just run to get the chametz and drink it right away. And anybody who has seen the lines outside of the, the Angel Bakery in Yerushalayim, after Pesach, people who haven't tasted bread for 7 days, they line out and you can wait on, I don't know what's going to be this year, but in general, you wait a long time online, and so what's the big deal? So you wait till tomorrow morning to buy your lachmaniot, to buy your rolls. But after I understood the idea of chametz, I heard this from the Rav of Kibbutz Yavna. He said, the idea of chametz is that you're missing out on something. Again, that's what the word lachmitz is. Lachmitz is damnut, is to miss out on an opportunity. Usually, we don't eat bread. As a matter of fact, unless you're eating a sandwich on the run, at least I usually don't eat bread. And if I miss out on bread, I don't really miss it. Until you cannot have it for a week, and then you really miss it. Everybody knows that the same thing with Sukkot. You don't really enjoy your home, you don't enjoy your house, until if you eat and sleep and live in a sukkah for 7 days with the cold and the heat, that is after 7 days to miss your house, that is when you appreciate your house. According to this, what is the idea of chametz? That we usually don't miss eating bread. But when we separate ourselves from eating bread and pizza and pretzels for 7 days, that helps us appreciate the small things in life. Just like the sukkah helps us appreciate our home, so too the chametz, the prohibition on eating chametz, missing out on chametz, helps us appreciate the daily simple bread. And if so, there's nothing wrong with waiting online for a long time, dying to eat your bread, or making havdalah right away on chametz beer. There's nothing wrong with it, because according to this explanation, that's part of the idea of the prohibition of chametz, is so that we can learn to appreciate the small things, like bread, that we usually take for granted. So that's a nice explanation on chametz.
I have a question.
Sure.
What did you say lahachmitz means?
Who is speaking?
Leah.
Ah, we don't see you. Lahachmitz literally means to miss out.
Okay.
And in this context, it really makes sense, because that's exactly, Cham is the prohibition, is that we want to miss our bread. We want to start missing it so that we appreciate it, the small things that Hashem gives us. Okay. Oh, my pleasure. My favorite explanation on the Haggadah is what we're about to say now. I heard this from Rav Bakshi Doron, who's the former chief rabbi of Israel. And he asks on the Rasha, the Ben HaRasha, the evil son. And I like to show my children different Haggadot, where they draw the evil son in different ways, and point out that you can't judge a person as a tzaddik or a rasha or a chacham by the way they look. But what does the evil son say? Maha avodah zot lachem. What is this service or these mitzvot that you do? Lachem v'lo lo. He says these mitzvot are for you and not for himself. Ulefi sha'otziya tatzmo min haklal kafar bi'ikar. This evil of the four sons, he excluded himself from the nation, and that is a terrible, terrible thing. It's as if you don't believe in the God of Israel, if you take yourself out of the people of Israel. And what's the answer? Ve'afata hake et shinav. What is hey kuf hey hey? When I was a kid, I thought hake et shinav means wrap him in the teeth, hit him. But most of you know enough Hebrew that I didn't know as a kid, that hake is hey kaf hey. Here the word is hey kuf hey hey, which literally means sour his teeth. What does that mean? Anyway, so this cynical son says to us, I don't want to be part of this Pesach Seder. So what do? It says, you also put vinegar on his teeth, put something sour on his teeth, and tell him, Bavur ze asa Hashem li betzeti mimisraim. It's because of these mitzvot that God took me out of Egypt. Li, he took me out of Egypt, velo lo, and not you. Ilu ayasham lo ayanigal. We tell the evil son that, you know what? Even if you were in Egypt, Hashem would not have taken you out. And obviously, there are a lot of difficulties here. Because first of all, if the evil son comes to the Leil HaSeder and you start yelling at him, he's going to run away. Right? This is not the way to be Makar of people, to bring them close to Torah. Right? First of all, say thank you that he came to the Seder. We all have non-religious relatives. Thank God, those that come to the Seder somehow are connected. There are many who don't come to the Seder. So, that's question number one. This is not the way we should answer a problematic child. Question number two, you should write down the questions. There, again, the answer answers all the questions. Question number two, this isn't the answer that the Torah gives. The Torah says in four different places, when your son shall tell you this, you shall answer this. When the Torah tells us this question, what is the ma'avodah zot lachem, the question which is attributed to the bad son, this is not the answer that the Torah gives. Right? We don't need to go into what the Torah does say to answer him, but since when are we educators better than HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why do we change the answer? Question number three. It's simply not true. We tell him, according to the Haggadah, we tell him, you know what? You are so bad that even if you were in Egypt, Hashem would not have taken you out. That's not true. Hashem took us all out of Egypt. Even our forefathers, most of them were paganists and idolaters, and they ate Gid HaNashen. They did not do Brit Milah. Hashem loved us, and he felt sorry for us, and he took us out of Egypt, even though we were not righteous. So why do we tell this evil son, if you were there, God would not have taken you out? It's not true. Now, the biggest difficulty is, what does it mean, put vinegar on his teeth? Put something sour on his teeth. What does that mean? And you will see in every Haggadah, it gives a totally, totally different explanation. But what we're going to say now, I am convinced, is the real, true explanation of what does it mean to put vinegar on your teeth. But there's one last question. We answer the Rasha, we say, Af ata, just like he spoke cynical to you, so too you do to him. And since when do we take revenge? Again, we should speak patiently, with tolerance, to the evil son. That's how you makariv people to Torah. Rabakshi Doron gave a beautiful, beautiful answer. He explained, today he's in his late 80s, maybe early 90s, and he explained that when he was a child growing up in Yerushalayim, the dentists, they didn't have x-ray machines. Maybe they had, but they couldn't afford them. So when a person went to the dentist would put vinegar on a tooth that hurt you to see your reaction. If you jump when the vinegar is on the tooth, that's a sign that the nerve is still alive, right? That there's what to work on the tooth. Put in a little filling. On the other hand, if the dentist puts vinegar on your tooth and you don't jump, that's an even more serious problem because it's a sign that the nerve of the tooth is dead. Rabakshi Doron explained so beautifully. There was, you people don't remember for sure, even Shlomit, who grew up here, may have heard of the Ne'um HaShfanim, the speech of the rabbits of Rav Shach. Rav Shach was one of the great Rabbanim of the previous generation. He was the head of Agudat Yisrael. And in 1990, without going into all the details of the political situation, there was a stalemate between the right-wing parties and the left-wing parties. And everybody wanted to know, is Agudat Yisrael going to go with the Likud, with Yitzhak Shamir at the time, the right-wing party? Or is he going to go with the Labor Party and Shimon Peres? And not only was all of Israel watching what was going on, they rented out Yad Eliyahu, that's the largest basketball stadium in the country, to wait for the words of this 97-year-old rabbi to say whether he was going with the Likud or with the Labor. The whole world wanted to know, is there going to be a peace process like the Labor wanted? Or is there not going to be a peace process like the Likud wanted? The entire world was waiting for this 97-year-old rabbi to say either right-wing or left-wing. That's what people wanted to hear. And Rav Shach, instead of saying right-wing or left-wing, he started talking about how the problem on the kibbutzim in Israel is that they work on Shabbat and they don't fast on Yom Kippur. And sometimes they even eat rabbits, and they don't keep kosher, and their kids don't know Shema Yisrael. And the whole world is trying to figure out, what's he talking about, people eating rabbits? What does that have to do with anything? And in the end, he said, the Labor Party, who founded the kibbutzim, and always had a tendency to be anti-religious, we cannot go with them. We are going with the Likud. But everybody wanted to know why he had to give that whole explanation about how the leftists eat on Yom Kippur and eat rabbits. And his son, Professor Ephraim Shach, he has one son who learned in Yeshiva University and a professor, modern Orthodox. And he asked his father, why did you lace into the non-religious people by putting them down for eating rabbits and for eating on Yom Kippur? And Rav Shach said, did you see the newspapers the following morning? His son said, yeah. Rav Shach said, what were the headlines of the newspapers? His son said, well, the headlines of the newspapers was the Labor Party was so angry at Rav Shach, not just because he went to the right wing and not with them, but they said You're saying we're not Jewish? And that was the headline of a famous article by Yossi Sarid, Ani Bichlal Lo Yehudi? What chutzpah do you have to say that I'm not Jewish? I spent 10 years as an officer in the Israeli army. I have given 20 years of my life in the Knesset. Okay, so it's not your party. I don't believe in your hashkafa, but I am just as Jewish as you are. Rav Shach said to his son, that is exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to put vinegar on their teeth to see if they jump. And they did. When Rav Shach said, they're not even Jewish. They eat rabbits. They eat on Yom Kippur. And he got the non-religious Jews in Israel so angry, saying, what do you mean we're not Jewish? We're just as Jewish as you are. We celebrate Pesach. Okay, we don't do it the same way that you do. We light Nerot Chanukah just like you do. We serve in the Israeli army. And Rav Shach said that is exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to get the non-religious to justify themselves that, yes, we are 100% Jewish just like you. And that, I think, is the beautiful explanation of Rabakshi Doron. What does it mean to put vinegar on their teeth? That's exactly what the dentist used to do. Put vinegar on their teeth and see if he jumps. Again, the Rasha, the Ben HaRasha, he is cynical. He says, the Torah is not for me, it's for you. So we, af ata emorlo, you answer him the same way. And even though it's not the proper way to be makarov people, this guy who's so cynical, and we don't know if his Jewish nerve is even alive or no, the way to do it is to put the vinegar on his teeth and tell him, you know what? Even if you were in Egypt, Hashem would not have taken you out. Correct. It's not true. But we want him to jump and to justify, I am Jewish. And I'm happy that I'm at the Seder. And that's exactly the approach of what we want to get the son to do. Why is this so convincing? It is the only explanation that I heard of that really explains the literal meaning, put vinegar on his teeth, which is something that Pashut in our modern world, we don't know what that means anymore. That's a beautiful explanation.
I really like that.
Yeah, it's nice. Let us go on. I want to say something, a Dvar Torah, in the name of my great-grandfather, who is the chief rabbi of Cleveland. He was the founder of the Young Israel of Cleveland, the first rabbi in Cleveland. And I only know of one Dvar Torah from his name that I heard from his grandfather. I'm named after him. My middle name, Yitzchak. His name was Ravi Yitzchak Yehuda Lefkowitz. And he said, we all remember that in the middle of Magid, we pick up the cup, and we say, V'hi she'amda la'avotenu v'lanu. This is what stood up for us and our forefathers, that in every generation, the anti-Semites tried to kill us. And Hashem always saves us. And there are a lot of different commentaries. What does it mean, V'hi she'amda? And this is what stood up for us. What is V'hi? You all know it's in Lashon Nekeva. So it has to be referring to something feminine. My great-grandfather explained that this is the cup that we are holding up. Kos, in Hebrew, the word kos, cup, is feminine. Vehi she'amda la'avotenu v'lanu. This cup, the wine, which is the basic difference between Jews and Gentiles throughout your generation. The fact that we did not go drink wine with them, we didn't go to the bars with them, that was part of the distance so that we could, that would prevent us from assimilation, from intermarriage. So what is Vehi She'amda? This cup. This is what enabled us to be zocheh that Hashem should come to save us throughout all of the generations. That's from my great-grandfather. Aiden.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Wait,
what is Vehi?
Vehi is talking about the cup.
Right, but what is the cup? I'm just
The cup represents the Isur of Yayin Nesech, right? That we don't drink wine with Gentiles. And that is what prevented us from being run over by the Gentiles over the Galut. Okay, tada. Aidan, your questions always help us clarify. Anybody else who has questions also, don't be embarrassed, even if I don't see you and your cameras are off. Don't be embarrassed. Another interesting point. We say in the Magid, Arami oved avi vayered mitzrayma. Lavan, literally it means, Lavan lost my father, Yaakov, and he went down to Egypt. Now what does it mean, Lavan lost my father? Rashi says, it means like, Nisan la'abed, he tried to lose my father. Lavan wanted to kill Yaakov, he wanted to get a... But it says that he did lose us. What did Lavan do to us? He didn't succeed. So why does it say that he did succeed? And what does it mean he lost us in Egypt? Lavan was in the northeast in Aram. Egypt is in the southwest. What does it mean, Arami oved avi, that Lavan lost my father Yaakov? And I saw many, many years ago, beautiful explanation. What did Lavan do? He gave Leah instead of Rachel. We all know that that is what caused Yaakov to have two wives. That's what caused the jealousy between the brothers. That's what caused the brothers to sell Yosef down to Egypt. And that is what brought us down to Egypt. In other words, Lavan really did succeed in getting us lost in Egypt for 200 years. Because even though he didn't physically send us down to Egypt, Lavan did succeed us because that small change of putting Leah instead of Rachel, that's what caused the jealousy, that's what caused selling the Yosef, that's what caused going down to Egypt. So in fact... Yeah, sure. The pasuk is Arami Oved Avi, and Chazal say it's referring to Lavan. Okay, Vakasha. What else? You got so many things, and we are running out of time. Oh, I want to hear something really interesting. Let's look together. If you have the sheets in Source 9, Source 8. Everybody remembers we say in the Haggadah that Bnei Yisrael multiplied and triplified, and Uvnei Yisrael paru v'yishritzu v'yirbu v'yatzmu b'mod ma'od v'temale aretz otam. Why does it say six times they were fruitful and they multiplied and they were like insects and they were many and they... Six times. So we all know the Midrash. Rashi brings down the Midrash that says that each woman had six tuplets, gave birth to six in every pregnancy. Right? You all know that, remember that from elementary school. And it sounds like one of those midrashim which is not meant to be taken literally. And in fact, most midrashim are not meant to be taken literally. Nevertheless, do some quick mathematics and you'll see something very interesting, that apparently this is meant to be taken literally. Why? Because it says, if you have the source sheet in source number 9, in Bamidbar Perek Gimel, Pasuk Lamed Tet, when they're counting the Levim and switching them off for the Bechorim, they count that there are 22,000. Kol Zachar miben Chodesh v'mala, 22,000. There are 22,000 male Bechorim in Israel. And they are exchanged after Chet Ha'Egel, when the Levim took over the Avodah instead of the firstborns. So there were 22,300 273 Levim. In other words, just 273 amount difference. And they are nifda. They are redeemed, those 273 extras, which, parenthetically, that's interesting. That means that when the Torah said there were 22,000 firstborns, that means that there were literally 22,000 and not 22,001 and not 21,999, because they were redeemed for 22,273, and the Torah does the cheshbon, what's the difference of 273? Anyway, because we usually think that the Torah is rounding out numbers, and sometimes it does. In this case, they're probably not rounding out numbers. But who cares that there were 22,000 bechorim? Chevra, very simple. If there are 22,000 bechorim, mathematically, statistically, there means there are also going to be 22,000 bechorot, right? For every male born, there is a female born. Okay, we got to 44,000 bechorim in Israel. Remember that number, okay? 44,000. How many Jews left Egypt? Well, we know there were 600,000 army-aged men from the age of 20 to 60. Now, if that's 600,000 army-aged men, that means that there are 600,000 women the same age. That's 1.2 million. Now, that doesn't count Levim. Add on another 40,000 Levim. Add on another 150,000 older people who are over the age of 60. Also, if you figure out how many young people were under the age of 20, everybody knows that every generation multiplies more than their parents. And according to the number of Yotzei Mitzrayim, if there were 600,000 men, I saw somebody figure out the statistics that there are probably 1.6 million children under the age of 20. Bikitsur, you don't have to go through the numbers if you want to. This shiur is going to be on the memory of Midrashat Moriah, so you can check down the numbers. It comes out to about 3 million Jews, men, women, old, young, Levim, who came out of Egypt. Okay, if there are about 3 million Jews, and how many Bechorim did we say?
44,000.
44,000. Ricky, I knew I could count on you. 44,000. What is 3 million divided by 44,000? It comes out to 65. In other words, for every Bechor, there are 65 siblings. Why is that significant? Because I saw in a book once in Africa where women eat just like they did 3,000 years ago, and their lifestyle is primitive just like 3,000 years ago. The average woman gave birth 11 times. Now, it's not so significant whether it's 9, 10, 11, 12, but that's just what it said. Now, if the average woman in the primitive world gives birth 11 times, and there are 65 children for every Bechor, that means that if there are she gave birth 11 times, that means that there were about 6 children in every birth. Now again, this sounds miraculous, and it sounded like one of those midrashim, which I always thought was not meant to be taken literally, but as soon as you figure out that there is only 44,000 bechorim to 3 million people, which means that there's only one Bechor for every 65 children. So that's pretty convincing, no? Yeah, Aiden.
I don't, what's the statistic with, like, the average primitive woman giving birth, like, 11 times? Where
does that come from? It is from a book on raising children after birth by, it's not Dr. Spock, Dr. Guttmacher. I can't believe that I remember his name. Dr. Guttmacher, ask your mothers. I would not be surprised if your mothers, many of them, have his book. It was a bestseller 20 years ago, around when you were born. And his name is Guttmacher. I can't believe I remember the name. Something about, like, on pregnancy and nursing, something like that. And he's the one who brings down what is done in the primitive tribes in Africa. Okay, we are running out of time. Let's see what else, what other goodies and surprises I can give you. Hold on. Okay, we're a couple more minutes, we can go. Oh, this is a nice idea. And this I might have mentioned in one of the shiurim in a context not connected with Pesach, but here it is connected with Pesach. We say, as a pasuk could say for Shmot, we say in the Haggadah, "Uvechol Elohei Mitzrayim Eseh Shvatim Ani Hashem." Hashem says, "I am not an angel. I struck the plagues. I struck all the gods of Egypt." And the obvious question is, where do we see God striking the gods of Egypt in the story of the Exodus? There is a Professor Yehuda in Hebrew University who is an Egyptologist. And he wrote a beautiful article of how in primitive Egypt, that's what an Egyptologist is, in primitive Egypt, you can check and you will find that the gods of primitive ancient Egypt were the addresses of each of the 10 plagues. For example, everybody knows that in all ancient paganist societies, if there is a major river, the water is the god, because that is where all the fruit and the vegetables comes from. So there's the god of the water called the Nile. When did God strike the god of the Nile? That's right. In Makat Dam. Right? When he turned the Nile into blood, cut down god number one. The goddess of fertility is a god in every paganist society. And in ancient Egypt, the goddess of fertility was a frog. And here, Makat Sfardea makes a mockery of the goddess of fertility. We also know that the priests in ancient Egypt, they used to shave their hair. Anybody who saw the movie The Ten Commandments remembers Yul Brynner. He played the role of Pharaoh. He shaved his hair. In all the pictures of the ancient pharaohs, why did they have shaved heads? Because Egypt is a very hot climate, and most of you have never been in the Middle East during the summer, but anybody who raises children in Israel knows that part of life in the Middle East in the summer is kinim. What are they called in English? The little things that... Lice. And they wanted to make sure that the priests and Paro, they weren't itching themselves all the time, and that was the Makkah of Kinim. I remember in fifth grade, we did a little about Egyptology, and I can't believe I still remember that the name of the god of the sun of Egypt was named Ra. It's easy to remember. Which of the Makot made a mockery of the god of the sun? You got it. Choshech. Right? When Hashem Pashut darkened the sun. We also know that Paro and his firstborn considered themselves gods. There's a pasuk in Yechezkel, Li Ori Vani Asitini, I made the Nile. And Makat Bechorot made a mockery of those gods. In other words, here we have an Egyptologist who knows all of the ancient gods of Egypt, and he's telling us, what does Aminu B'chol Elohei Mitzrayim Eseh Shvatim? Hashem says, I will punish all of the gods of Egypt. The answer is, the Eser Makot were punishing the gods of Egypt. Another interesting thing, once we're on the topic of the Eser Makot, there's a paragraph in the Halach, in the Haggadah, where Rabbi Yossi says, there weren't 10 Makot, there were 50 Makot. And Rabbi Lezer says, not 50 makot, there were 200 makot. And Rabbi Akiva says, not 200 makot, 250 makot. And like we said before, everybody knows that Midrashim are not meant to be taken literally. And we don't have a list of what these 200 or 250 makot are. But what is this Midrash trying to do when they're just adding 10 makot is pretty good, right? Especially if it tears down each of the Egyptian gods. So why do they want to make it into not 10, 200, 250? What's going on? The Vilna Gaon gives a beautiful explanation. He says there's a pasuk that says, Kol amachala asher samti b'mitzrayim lo asim alecha. All of the plagues that I gave unto Mitzrayim, Hashem says, I will not give on to the Jewish people. If so, the more makot that we learn out, the better it is for the Jewish people. It's a shame there was not a makah of corona, because we would be saved from that makah. V'kitzur, y'all catch that? Why do we try and add on to the number of makot? Because the pasuk tells us, all of the makot that I brought on Egypt, I'm not going to bring on to you. The more makot that there were, the better it is for us. Another interesting point, maybe I should have mentioned this at the beginning, you all know that there are two tavshilim on the Seder plate. The minhag is to have a beitza, an egg, in memory of the Korban Chagiga, and the zroa, a roasted shank bone, in memory of the Korban Pesach. But if you learn Masechet Pesachim, it does not say egg, shank bone. I think egg is given as one of the examples, but it could be selek v'orez. It could be fish and chips. It could be any two dishes. Any two dishes have to be on the Seder plate. Why? Chevre, let's think for a minute. Does this idea of giving two dishes sound familiar? That's Mishloach Manot. Why do we have to give two different types of food on Mishloach Manot? That's a sign of osher, of wealth, of friendship. Similarly, the opposite. Maybe some of you may know the halacha that an Erev Tisha B'Av in the Suda Mafseket, right before we begin the fast of Tisha B'Av, there's halacha that you're not allowed to have two tavshilim. You're not allowed to have fish and chips. Either fish or chips. Many people in most families, they have a big meal Erev Tisha B'Av in the afternoon, and then right before Tisha B'Av, they just eat bread and ashes with a egg, right? But what is the halacha? The halacha is not, you're not allowed to have two cooked dishes. If so, we have three examples of the idea that having two cooked dishes is a sign of wealth, of freedom. My mother-in-law, Zichrona Livracha, whenever she had guests, she always made a point of offering at least two main dishes. Choose chicken or meat. Choose this or that. That's a sign of freedom. And that is why on the Seder plate, you could use an egg in memory of this and a shank bone in memory of that. But the main point you should remember is to have two dishes at Shulchan Orech. During the Pesach meal, you're supposed to have two dishes. Why? Just like Mishloach Manot is two dishes. Just like Erev Tisha B'Av, you're not allowed to have two dishes. Because the idea of having two baked dishes is a sign of what? Freedom. Osher. Standard of living. Maybe we'll just finish up with a short thought of the Chad Gadya. Chad Gadya is all the way at the end of the Seder, and it's a nice song, and everybody likes singing it, but I bet in most of your families, by the time we get to Chad Gadya, nobody's giving too many Divrei Torah. And you'll see in the commentaries on the Haggadah, there aren't that many Divrei Torah on the Chad Gadya, but here, you will have one. Chevra, this is from Rabbi Yonatan Ipshitz. Rabbi Yonatan Ipshitz looks at the Chad Gadya, and we all know that it begins that my father bought a little gdi, a little goat, for his son. And then came the cat and ate the gdi, which means that the cat is the bad guy. But then came the dog and ate the cat. So the dog is the good guy, right? The dog is just coming to defend the goat. But then comes the chutra, the stick, and it beats the dog. So if the dog was the good guy, the stick is on the side of the bad guy. And the fire burns the stick, so the fire is the good guy. But the water puts out the fire, and that's the bad guy. And then came the bull and drinks the water. He's a good guy. But comes the shochet and kills the bull. So the shochet's a bad guy. And then comes the malach hamavet to kill the shochet. Turns out that the malach hamavet is a good guy. And then comes HaKadosh Baruch Hu and kills the malach hamavet. Turns out that God is the bad guy. He's on the wrong side. Right? You all understand the question? Again, the gdi is an innocent goat. The cat eats the gdi, so the cat is the aggressor. The dog who eats the cat is just sticking up for the goat, so he's a good guy. And it just goes good, bad, good, bad, good, bad. But the problem is, that way it turns out the malach hamavet is the good guy, and God is the bad guy, and that cannot be. If so, says Rabbi Yonatan Eibshitz, how do we solve the query? He says, we don't know what the goat did to the cat. It might have been that the goat started up with a cat. So the goat is the bad guy and the cat is the good guy, and then everything is turned around, and it turns out that HaKadosh Baruch Hu obviously is the good guy. And what's the moral of the story? Even when you see that somebody seems like totally innocent and he's a totally good guy, and you see somebody on the other hand who's a bad guy. I remember when I was a kid and they used to draw cartoons, the villains always looked the same. You know, you could tell who's the villain, and the good guys always look like nice people. Like I said before at the beginning, you know, you look in the Haggadah and you see the way they draw the four sons. Then a good son is always a goody-goody with glasses, and he's reading, and he's always learning. And the bad son is wearing a baseball hat, and he is the bad son because he doesn't learn Torah. And like we said at the beginning, you can't judge people by the way they look. And that is something that should be fixed in all of the Haggadot. Don't draw people. Yeah, there are some who are good, there are some who are bad, or there's this, there's that. But don't label people by the way that they look. Similarly, in the Chagadiah, just because the cat ate the goat, that does not mean that the cat is the bad guy. Because you don't know how the story began with what the goat did to the cat. Chevra, have a Chag Kasher v'Sameach.